Antoine Sutton? Brant paused, his hand on the door handle.
No, he said, shaking his head, flustered.
You sure?
She said, turning her head just a little bit over her shoulder. Yes, I'm fucking sure. Don't know anyone named Antoine He struggled to remember the last name.
Sutton.
Sutton, yeah, don't know him. Is that it, goddammit?
Yeah, that's it, Vega said.
Then she tapped the screen once and lifted her phone to her ear, making a call.
I guess he has a nickname, though. Some people call him Rascal.
Brant turned back to face her, dropped his phone to the floor, looked like he'd been rabbit-punched.
Oh, you know him?
She said, genuinely curious to know.
I'm calling him right now. You want to talk to him?
Brant jumped for her, but she stood and hiked her jacket up to show him the gun.
You owe him some money, right? Like 10K or something?
All for what? Poker and blackjack and horses?
Give me the phone, you bitch! Give me the fucking phone!
Vega moved to the other side of the table, pushed her jacket back, rested her hand on the grip of the Springfield.
It's ringing, she said, excited.
Brant had begun wheezing, gripping handfuls of dirty, wheat-colored hair.
Please,
he whispered.
Is this Rascal?
Said Vega, suddenly calm and unamused.
You're looking for a guy named Kevin Brant, right?
That cocksucker is standing right in front of me.
Please.
Hold on a second. Vega lifted the phone away from her ear and tapped the screen with her thumb.
He's on mute. Do you know where the girls are?
No, I swear, said Brant. I haven't seen them in 8 years.
Do you know someone named Evan Marsh?
No,
he said, shaking his head to show her how serious he was about it.
No one has contacted you within the last week about their whereabouts, and you've observed nothing out of the ordinary that you can recall.
No, I swear, I promise.
Don't promise, said Vega, disgusted. What are you, a fucking Cub Scout?
Brant gripped the end of the table and rubbed his nose, eyes, trying not to cry. Vega touched her phone screen and began to speak.
Sorry about that. Wrong guy. If I find him, I'll call you.
She hung up, put away her phone and gun. Brant began to take choppy breaths through his mouth, still gripping the table's edge.
Okay, so listen, said Vega. You don't need a lawyer. Tell the detectives everything they want to know and stay close for a few days. You step on a crack, I call Rascal.
Brant continued to gasp.
Say you understand me, said Vega, now annoyed.
I understand you.
Great, she said. Have a seat.
She turned to face the mirror, knowing it was Hollows and Kaplan back there. She hoped she was looking at Kaplan when she nodded, not at Hollows or into the space between them, but it was hard to tell. From this side, all she could see was her own face, unrecognizable in the room's yellow light. Kevin Brant looked like a different guy when he came out of the room with Vega. Suddenly his clothes seemed ill-fitting, his skin pallid.
"You need anything else from Brant?" said Vega, as if he weren't next to her.
"We'll get his contact information. We can arrange for you to stay at a motel the next few nights, Mr. Brant. That all right?"
said Junior.
Brant nodded, said nothing.
"Detective Rawls can take care of that for you."
Rawls led Brant away quietly, and Cap couldn't help smiling.
"Rascal?"
"That's the man's name," Vega said, not smiling exactly, but her eyes suggesting that she might start soon.
Then she looked at her phone, and everything in her face hardened up.
"What?"
said Cap.
"It's Gail White," said Vega. "She called me 3-4 times.
Vega pressed the phone to her ear while she kept her eyes on Cap. He thought about how you never knew you were going to get good news before you heard it, but bad news you could always sense coming. You didn't even have to guess.
Cap and Vega drove to Jamie Brant's parents' house, where there were 4 news vans parked, but none of their lights on and no correspondents or producers outside. Vega glanced at the numbers on the vans. Everyone local. No cable. That meant word hadn't gotten out yet, or there was just bigger news at the moment, which was possible. Cap parked across the street, and they walked across quickly. Vega heard a van door slide open as she and Cap hit the driveway, past the line the reporters could cross.
"Miss Vega, any break in the case?" a man called to her.
Vega thought of bones and glass, and the front door opened, Maggie behind it. "She's been up there an hour," she said.
"That them?"
Gail called from the other room.
"Yeah, that's them," said Maggie, annoyed. "Who else are you expecting?"
Vega and Cap came into the kitchen, where Gail stood wearing a down coat, the back door open.
"You're the one she asked for, missy," she said to Vega sourly. "Arlen put a ladder out, but she don't want anyone up there."
Arlen White appeared, coming in through the back door, out of breath. He cast his thumb over his shoulder behind him, pointing outside.
"Did she talk about hurting herself?" said Cap.
Gail shook her head at him.
"No, sir. She just took a bottle of Smirnoff with her."
Cap caught Vega's eye, and she nodded at him. "Got it." Everyone stood around for a second, not moving.
"Well, go on, then, if you're gonna go," said Gail to Vega.
Vega went out the kitchen door, through the garage to the outside, along the back of the house. The house next to the Whites was only a few yards away, a chain fence dividing the property. There was hardly any light at all, no moon that she could see, only a dim sconced bulb above the back door. An extension ladder was propped up against the house, next to one of the living room windows. Vega climbed it.
"Better be you, Alice,"
Jamie said, before Vega reached the top.
"It's me."
Vega stepped off the top rung and onto the roof, where it tilted at a small angle around the perimeter. Jamie sat in the middle, where it was flat, with her knees to her chest, holding the vodka to her side. Vega approached her, but didn't get too close, stood next to her, facing what she was facing, which was the street, a patch of woods, a satellite from one of the vans.
"We have a new lead," said Vega. "A guy named John McKee. Do you know that name?"
Jamie tried to shake her head, but it was like there was a delay between her head and her neck.
"What about Dina Mocked?"
"Nah,"
Jamie said.
"I never heard of them. Who are they?"
Vega told her, and couldn't tell if Jamie was listening. She was drunk, and her head kept tipping forward and snapping back up as she almost fell asleep and caught herself. "Also, I met your ex-husband," said Vega. Jamie registered this, turned to look at Vega, and laughed.
"Yeah. He didn't know anything, right?"
"Right," said Vega. "You should talk to your lawyer. The government will garnish his wages for child support, but he might go to jail before that." Jamie nodded mechanically.
"I don't even care," she said. "Money, no money. Jail, no jail."
She closed her eyes and breathed deeply, like she was at the beach.
"This guy I read about killed himself by cutting his wrists and then jumping off a building."
"You can't kill yourself, Jamie," said Vega. "Your girls are going to need you."
"Oh, come the fuck on,"
said Jamie, turning on Vega, lips dark with lipstick or just chapped from being bit.
"This is what I wanted to ask you. What are the odds of them being alive now? Really? You do this for a living. I've read a bunch of shit online."
She did not finish her thought, just peered straight ahead, into the woods. "What I do," said Vega, "has nothing to do with odds." Jamie rolled her eyes and took a swig from the bottle.
"That's some fast and furious shit right there,"
she said, pointing at Vega. Then she mimicked her.
"What I do has nothing to do with odds, baby."
Jamie started hiccuping, a wet, indigestive sound. She pressed her fingers to her lips.
"You going to be sick?" said Vega.
Jamie didn't respond, just put her head down and shuddered her shoulders.
"Jamie?"
Vega moved a little closer, tried to see her face, but the streetlight wasn't bright enough. Jamie still didn't look up, and now the bottle dropped from her hands and hit the roof, dully, rolled toward the edge. Vega ran to her just as Jamie went limp, and Vega caught her before she tipped fully over.
"Jamie! Jamie! Jamie!"
Vega said her name over and over, but Jamie couldn't hear her. She was in another place now, foam bubbling out of her mouth, and lying in Vega's arms, still warm. At the hospital, Cap paced in the waiting room while Jamie had her stomach pumped. Cap had seen the process a few times as a cop, and every time he thought about the accuracy of the term because it was like something you would do to a septic tank to flush it out. Stick in a tube and apply suction until everything comes up and out. Jamie's parents had been taken into the rhesus area with her. Cap and Vega were left in the waiting room, while Maggie filled out forms with the triage nurse. Vega stood typing on her phone with her thumb, leaning against the wall. She had a streak of Jamie's vomit across her shirt. She hadn't looked Cap in the eye since right before she'd gone to the roof. He had an urge to tell her it wasn't her fault. None of it was. But he couldn't figure out a way to do it that wasn't patronizing. His phone buzzed with a text. "Nell. You okay? It's late even for you." Cap typed,
"I'm okay. Jamie swallowed a bunch of pills with half a bottle of vodka. At ER."
He watched the three dots flash at the bottom of the screen and pictured Nell's face. "Terrible," she wrote back. "Will she be okay?"
"Hopefully," texted Cap. "Usually 4-hour window good."
He paused, then added,
"Go to bed."
She sent back a rolling eye face, and Cap smiled. He tried to find a face that implied fatherly worry without being pushy, but there was really nothing in that department. Just heart eyes. Then Arlen White emerged from the back, looking stunned. He turned a flat wool hat around in his hands like a wheel. Maggie, Cap, and Vega gathered around him.
"Arlen, what is it?"
said Maggie, a plea in her voice. Arlen coughed into his elbow, then said,
"She's gonna be all right. They took everything out of her. They're gonna keep her overnight at least."
"Oh, thank God,"
Maggie said, and she pressed her clasped hands to her chest, as if she were going to start praying right then.
"That's good news," Cap said to him.
Arlen smiled very faintly, then turned to Vega and said,
"Ma'am."
"Yes?"
answered Vega. He stopped turning the hat and said,
"Been gone a week now."
Vega exhaled a small breath and said, "Yes." Arlen nodded. Then he addressed all of them.
"You can go. Gail wants to stay, of course."
Maggie asked if he was sure, and he said yes, he was, and that was all. He turned and went back through the swinging double doors to where his wife sat next to a cot that held his daughter, knocked out from the trauma to her insides. The three of them left the ER in silence and made their way to the parking lot, where Maggie said good night, but didn't make a move to leave.
"You okay, Miss Chambly?"
said Cap. Maggie nodded, distracted. Then she said quietly, her eyes cast down,
"How many of the 18 people took more than a week to find, Miss Vega?"
Vega's nose crinkled up as she paused. Cap knew she didn't have to think about it, but she knew how long it had taken her to find every one of the 18, because she thought about them all the time when she wasn't working a new case, because she kept living and reliving the old cases over and over, that she probably dreamed about them the way a starving man dreamed about food. "3, said Vega. Maggie put her hand to her cheek like she was checking herself for a temperature.
"And out of those 3, one of them was dead, and one was alive, but,"
she said, tapping her head,
dead?
Vega nodded.
Right, said Maggie solemnly.
Then again,
right. You'll let me know how your lead goes?
Yes, of course, said Vega.
I'll send you a text in the morning, Maggie said. Tell you how Jamie's doing.
That would be great, said Cap, wanting to make everything easier for everyone.
Then they all said goodnight and got into their cars. Cap headed for the inn and drove a few blocks before saying anything.
Alive but dead, he said. What does she mean?
Vega rolled her shoulders one at a time, stretching. Then she spoke. It was a girl in the valley, near L.A. Christy Polonez, 12 years old. Her uncle kidnapped her, put her in a basement, filmed her with three men at a time, four men at a time, knocked her teeth out so she could give them a smoother ride. She'd been down there 2 weeks when I found her, real out of it, but I thought it was the drugs they'd given her. Her parents were so happy she was alive that they didn't care at first that she wasn't talking in sentences. Then they did a press conference. They wanted to thank the city, the police, me. Vega paused, rubbed her hands on her pants legs as if she were wiping something off. So the press is asking, Christy, how does it feel to be back home? And Christy's just smiling. Smiling, 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 like a drunk. And everyone's happy and laughing and being encouraging, you know, because this is a good story for everyone. Everyone likes to see the kids come home. And Christy's looking at the cameras and starts taking her clothes off. Because in her brain, now and forever, when she sees a camera, that's what she's supposed to do. Vega stopped, and Cap could tell there was more, but that she was deciding whether or not to tell him.
What happened to her? He asked.
Vega sighed. Her mother covered her up and took her away. Last I heard, they were homeschooling her because she couldn't function in a regular school. That's what happens, Kaplan, and they're gone more than a week. 2 weeks. She pointed to her head. Train goes off the tracks.
Not unequivocally, said Cap. Every case is different.
She stared out the passenger window now, removing herself from the conversation.
Vega, everyone's had a shitty night. They're all just hitting an emotional wall. We've both seen this before, he said.
You don't have to do that, she said.
Do what?
Attempt the pep talk.
I am not attempting pep talk, he said. I am sharing my experience.
Okay, that's enough, said Vega. She wasn't laughing or even smiling, but she seemed suddenly to have more energy, inspired in some odd way by his sappiness. As they pulled up to the inn, she checked her phone and said, So Wilkes-Barre is, what, 50 miles?
Sounds about right, said Cap. What's in Wilkes-Barre?
Dina Mocht's parents, she said, getting out of the car. You'll tell Trainer we're heading there in the morning?
I guess I will, said Cap, taking a sip of a 4-hour-old coffee from a wax paper cup. Pick up at 7?
He looked at the time on the dash. 3:06. Vega shrugged. 7:30, she said, and turned and went up the path to the inn, lit on either side by gas lamps for charm purposes. Cap laughed once and loudly before starting the car. She may or may not have slept, but when it came down to it, did she need to? As long as she was lying down with closed eyes, pretending to be asleep, could a body really tell the difference? She thought about this while standing on her hands. There was congestion in her nose. She felt the block as she tried to breathe deeply. She gave up and breathed through her mouth. A no-no in yoga. So turn me in, she thought. Call the yoga police. She heard a bird, but it wasn't a song, more like an effort at communication. Persistent, repetitive, rhythmic. No birds answered him. It was just that one. And the more Vega heard his weird calls, the more she swore he was actually speaking English. One word over and over. Here, here, here. She opened her eyes, and there were the girls again, in their white dresses with the black sashes. Vega knew this was not really Kylie and Bailey speaking to her. She knew her mind was feeding her the images, pulling them from horror movies. The Shining twins, the little girl with the braids who kills her classmates, the gang of blonde kids with their glowing eyes. But they sure looked like Kylie and Bailey, even if they were fakes. They looked at each other, at Vega. "What?" Vega said to them, sweat trickling up her chin, onto her lips. That's when Kylie got on one knee and came up close to her face. Vega could feel the warm air of her breath as she spoke. "You're probably gonna die today." Chapter 13 Dina Mocht's parents lived out in Wilkes-Barre. Cap drove on a county road, and out the window were woods and farmhouse conversions. How could anyone sleep listening to crickets and cats and a car down the street once a day? Out here, you would watch it come and go from your window, anxious, then relieved. They found the house down a road that was paved, but just barely. They parked and could not find a path of any kind, so they walked in the grass toward the house, which had two boxy stories with an A-frame roof. Cap expected to see some chickens or a pig running around in the front yard, but instead of animals, there were about 15 dishwashers, tented under a blue tarp. Cap rubbed his eyes reflexively, as if the gesture would make him more awake. But he wasn't. He was on the ropes of consciousness, even after he'd drunk a cup of coffee while he shaved and finished a thermos in the car on the way to Vega's. He still knew if he closed his eyes for more than a few seconds, he would collapse. He felt like a senior citizen, even though he knew that 41 wasn't old anymore, that lots of men became first-time fathers in their 40s, or dated women half their age, went back to school, allowed themselves to be in love. But not him. And not now. Vega was showing signs, too. She had seemed aggressively youthful back in the old days earlier in the week, energy buzzing off her even while she sat silent in the passenger seat. Now she was moving slowly, head tilted down, waited. A woman came through the screen door and stood on the porch, looking at them. Pockmarks lined her cheeks, her eyes clear and blue. She didn't speak. Cap stood up straight and said,
"Mrs. Mocht?"
"Yes. You Mr. Cap'n?"
"Kaplan, yes. This is Alice Vega."
Mrs. Mocht nodded at them, a little suspicious.
"May we come in for a minute?" Cap said.
She nodded again and went inside, holding the door open. They followed her. The living room seemed too small for all the furniture. Tables and couches and chairs, lining the walls, a rug with woven concentric circles in the middle of the floor that made Cap dizzy.
"Let me get my husband," Mrs. Mocht said.
She stood in a doorway leading to other rooms and yelled,
"Mitch, these folks are here."
Mrs. Mocht did not sit, and did not tell them to sit. She crossed her arms and pulled her thick sweater tight across her chest. Then Mitchell Mocht came in. He was fat and had a mottled blonde goatee on his chin. He shook hands with Cap, nodded at Vega, and seemed to be out of breath.
"You're looking for Dina," he said. "That's right," said Cap. "She's staying at my dad's cabin down Woodgrove."
"Where's that, exactly?"
"About 10-15 miles east of Frackville. Back toward you and Denville, I'm afraid. You gotta go a bit off the interstate."
"Is your father with her there?"
"Nah, he's dead," said Mocht,
no emotion in any direction.
"She's been staying there while she looks for work."
Mrs. Mocht emitted a sigh that sounded like a honk. Her husband glanced at her, and she left the room.
"You looking for her ex? For John?"
said Mocked.
"Yes. He's trouble. I always knew it. Dina was doing okay before she met him. She was going to junior college and had a job. Everything."
Cap nodded, pictured Nell.
"You said ex. They're not together romantically, as far as you know?" "Yeah, she got rid of him," said Mocked proudly. "She knew it was bad news."
"Do you have a number where we could reach her? We'd like to ask her if she's heard from the key at all in the past month."
"She just changed her cell phone. She couldn't get reception up there with AT&T.
Cap thought for a quick second, remembered Charlie Bright's mother making excuses for him.
"Is there a landline?"
he said.
"Yeah."
Mocked paused. Cap watched him struggle, eyes batting around, lips tightening over the teeth. All marks of a witness who is not a great liar, trying to decide whether or not to admit something.
"It's been out of order for a while," he added quickly. "So what would be the best way to get in touch with her?" "You could, leave her a message on the cell, and when she gets it, she'll call you back."
"We don't really have too much time to wait for that, Mr. Mocked," said Cap. "You understand we're looking for the Brandt girls. Every minute we lose, we get further away from finding them alive and safe. I'm sure you can appreciate that."
"Yeah, of course," said Mocked, pained. "I could drive you up there myself. I usually go see her every other Friday. I don't want to take her by surprise."
Cap's jaw throbbed where Rawls had hit him, made him feel foggy, like he had to unpack things more than usual.
"I'm sorry," he said. "Can I ask you what you mean by that? You don't want to take her by surprise?"
Mock took a few seconds to compose a response. Then Cap heard Vega's voice. "You know what he means by that?" Vega said. Cap turned, saw that Vega was talking to Mrs. Mocked, who had reappeared in the doorway, smoking a cigarette.
"Yeah, I know," said Mrs. Mocked.
"Ro, we talked," Mocked said to her.
"I know we talked about it, you damn old fool," said Mrs. Mocked, not at all affectionately.
"My wife, she doesn't have a lot of patience for Dina," said Mocked.
"Just shut up, Mitch," snapped Mrs. Mocked. "Shut your mouth and quit telling lies."
Mocked looked like he was about to protest, but then didn't, sank back into the couch like a sandbag. Mrs. Mocked came into the room and addressed Cap and Vega, didn't look at her husband.
"That girl didn't need John McKee or anyone else to turn her into a deadbeat," she said, spite drawing down the corners of her mouth. "She did that all by herself. Started sniffing glue and paint thinner when she was 12 years old. First abortion at 15, second at 17.
Mrs. Mocked tapped the side of her head forcefully.
"Something missing up here. Always was."
"Ro,"
Mocked said sadly.
"No, Mitch," she said. "I tried to sit here and listen to you lie to these people to make yourself feel better. I ain't doing it."
She shook her head, laughed to herself.
"She faked my signature on a check. That's when I called the cops. We work our whole lives and then we're gonna lose our damn house 'cause she wants to smoke drugs. No way. No way, Jose."
She looked at her husband over her shoulder, dismissive.
"He didn't want me to do it either. If it was up to him, we'd be on welfare 'cause of her, 'cause he's a fool."
Mocked said nothing, stared at the globe of his stomach.
"Ma'am," said Cap, "do you think your daughter is still involved with John McKee, or do you agree with Mr. Mocked?"
"I don't agree with Mr. Mocked about anything," she said. "So, yeah, I'm sure they're still together, and I'm sure he's with her right now at that cabin. And what Mr. Mocked didn't want to tell you is there was a landline, but she's never paid a bill in her life, so there's no electricity and no running water up there. They just smoke drugs by candlelight, It's a real romantic scene. Only way you're gonna find them is if you drive there yourselves.
We can do that, said Cap.
I gotta give you directions, said Mrs. Mocked. Address won't come up on internet maps.
She went to a small table where there was a phone and scratched out notes on a slip of paper.
If you talk to her, if she isn't passed out or what have you, she said, handing Cap the note, can you give her a message for me?
Of course. Mrs. Mocked blew out a cloud of smoke, aimed above Cap's head to be polite, and she looked a little shaky just then. Maybe the screws and bolts that locked up her daily rage were loosening, Cap thought. Then, she said,
tell that dumb bitch she still owes me $6,800.
They followed a series of splintered roads according to Mrs. Mocked's directions until they were officially lost. There was a house every quarter mile or so, each one more rustic than the last. Smaller and smaller windows and doors, lawns shrinking and turning into woods, until they didn't see any houses or cars for 10 minutes. The landscape reminded Vega of a program she'd seen on TV once, something like When the Humans Die. Vegetation growing wild, vines covering houses and cars, doing the quiet work of decomposition. She watched her phone, which still retained a flicker of reception, but the message kept coming back that the internet could not find her location. The ticks of the circle in the upper left corner spun. Searching, searching. Cap decided they better turn around, but then Vega saw something up ahead. A flash of white. Headlights and tires jutting out from the trees. A truck. Cap rolled into the gutter of the road and turned off the car. Vega got out, smelled the salty smoke of a fire somewhere close. She heard a dissonant bird song, 3 mismatched notes on a loop. She examined the pickup, the paint faded to beige, dirt coating the tires and fender. Her eyes followed the scrap of a driveway back to a cabin the size of a gas station bathroom, surrounded by trees, and on the porch a man kneeling, working at something. Cap went first, stepping quietly around the truck.
"Excuse me," he called, his voice amplified.
Vega nodded, approving his volume. Best not to surprise anyone out here. Closer to the house now, she saw the man crouching, cleaning a stool with a spray bottle and a rag. There was also a folding chair and an old tube television. The man glanced up as they came to the clearing and said,
"Folks lost!"
He was in his 70s, with hair that looked recently shaved, just sprouting white spikes in a semicircle on his head and also his face. Cap came forward and said yes, introduced himself and Vega. The man didn't offer his name.
"We are looking for a woman named Dina Mocked. Do you know that name?"
said Cap.
"Mocked, sure," said the man. "You're all turned around, realize?"
He stood now, wiping his hands with the rag.
"Yeah, we thought as much," said Cap.
The man gave them some directions. Turn around, a left where they had taken a right, follow the unmarked road with a broken roadblock sign to the Mocked cabin.
"I've seen the girl and her boyfriend in town," said the man with the air of a conspirator. "They got problems."
"What makes you say that?"
"That girl? Dina?" said the man. "I used to see her with her granddad when he built the place. She used to be cute. Now she's got holes in her face from the drugs."
He seemed genuinely saddened by it.
"Have you seen them lately? In the last few days?" "No, I ain't seen them," he said. "Couple weeks, probably. You friends of theirs?"
"We know Dina's parents," said Cap.
The man nodded. That was enough for him.
"Well, she owes money to everyone in town. Surprised they haven't torched the place yet," he said.
Then, as an afterthought,
"I don't trust people from New York, personally. Think they got an attitude."
At first Vega thought somehow he'd picked up Cap's trace Brooklyn accent, even though Vega heard it in only a few of his words, when he said call for call. Cap met her eyes, registering the anomaly.
"Who's from New York now?"
said Cap. The man dropped the rag on the folding chair and pulled a tissue from his pocket, rubbed it on the back of his neck.
"Her boyfriend, right? The tall guy? He's got a damn giant sticker on his car," he said,
impatient suddenly, like Cap and Vega were dense not to get it before. Vega's head burned in the middle, the realization blistering outward, fire eating up the fuses. She turned around and left first, heard Cap thank the man and not wait for him to say anything back before Cap followed her, both of them walking, then running through the white trees which were peeling, flaps of bark hanging off with the red wood underneath. Vega knew it was probably natural for whatever kind of tree it was, but it still looked like a disease, a hemorrhage, something to be cured or killed. They found the roadblock, faded orange stripes on two planks with a handwritten detour sign. Vega got out and moved the sign to the side of the road while Cap tried dialing Trainer, then Junior, then M, but there was no answer. No click and no ring, just the low hum of not connecting. Cap leaned his head out the window and said, "I have no bars, no dots. Do you have service?" Vega got back in and ran her thumb over the face of her phone. "No," she said. Cap pulled ahead slowly, hearing the wheels crush gravel, the car rocking unevenly over the dips. He kept one hand on the wheel and the other on the phone, hitting Trainer again. Trainer, calling work. Nothing. "Kaplan, brake," said Vega. Cap glanced up a little too late, and the car slid into a ditch. He yanked the wheel right and pulled out, the fender cracking the edge.
"Shit."
"Kaplan," said Vega, "maybe we should walk a while."
"Yeah,"
he said, pulling over. He turned off the engine, and they both stepped out. The morning was turning warm, the air clear, clouds moving fast. Spring for real, thought Cap. Vega straightened her jacket at the bottom and shrugged one shoulder, adjusting the holster and the pistol underneath. Cap typed out a text to Trainer, Junior, and M as he walked to the trunk. "We're 15 miles east of Frackville. Bumper sticker on McKee's car matching descriptive Ridgewood Mall car." He hit send and watched the bar at the top hang in the middle. He opened the trunk and reached for the micro-vault, tapped in his code, 1107, Nell's birthday, and pressed his right index finger over the fingerprint scanner. The lock clicked and he opened the case. There was his sig, right where he had left it the day he lost his job. When he was a cop, he'd carried it every day and kept it clean, but never had been one to fetishize it like some other cops. Never gave it a woman's name or obsessively polished the steel. Never had a collection at home or subscribed to publications for gun enthusiasts. It had just been a tool of the job, a stethoscope for a doctor. And when he lost his job, he had put it in the vault in his bedroom closet and forgot about it. Until this morning. He loaded the clip and peered down the barrel. "When's the last time you had that in your hand?" said Vega.
"Day I lost my job."
"That's all kind of pathetic," she said. Cap smiled and slid the gun down the small of his back. Undid and fastened his belt to the next hole to tighten it up. They walked the road, which grew narrower still, the width of a compact car and not an inch more. Cap looked at his phone again, cupping his hand over the top to shade the screen from the glare. The texts read as delivered, but his phone was so old he never knew. He wrote one more.
"Copy back."
Hit send. Then redialed Junior. Not even a ring. The screen black.
"Can you get anything?" he asked Vega.
She shook her head. Cap stopped walking. He remembered plenty of times when young cops were too hot to see some action, started making poor decisions. Jules had told him some boys' frontal lobes, the part of the brain that processes consequences, didn't develop until they were in their mid-20s, and Cap could believe it. Taking a bad shot, searching and seizing without a warrant, walking into an unknown situation without backup. He could just see the outline of the cabin about 100 feet away, the shape of a one-story A-frame shimmering through the trees. Vega continued to walk ahead of him and soon realized he wasn't right behind her, that he had stopped. She turned and held her hands out, impatient. Coming? Cap didn't speak, gestured come here with one hand. Vega looked at him sideways and came back, small clouds of dust kicking up from her feet. Then she was right in front of him, breathing fast and heavy. What is it? There was no way to say it, except to say it. No bubble wrap he could duct tape to the thing to make it more attractive to her.
We have to go back, he said, calmly resigned.
What's that? Vega said back, as if she had a bad ear.
To the old man's house. See if he has a landline we can use.
Vega stared at him, her mouth a little slack, in shock. We're right here, she said. The girls are in there right now. She spoke slowly so he wouldn't miss anything.
They could be, said Cap. And McKee and Dina could be armed. So let's say we have a little gunfight, and they shoot us, and we die. Then the girls are still in there, and no one knows where they are.
Cap watched her face for a reaction, but there was none. She gazed at him, forehead wrinkled.
And we're dead, he added.
They're junkies, not gangsters. They got in over their heads, she said. We can handle them.
All circumstantial. We're talking about 30 minutes here. That's the trade. 30 minutes for odds of a significantly better outcome.
Vega stepped closer, up to his face, close enough so he could smell the herbiness of her breath and see her nostrils puff with air. This could be the 30 minutes, Kaplan, she said, her eyes shining, reflecting the severely clear sky. She continued, when they rape them, or kill them, or cut off their thumbs and their ears because they're panicking. She was earnest and not angry, and Cap knew the real bitch of it was that they were both right. This is the 30 minutes, she said, firm. This is it. Right now. Cap thought of this. When Nell was 12, she learned about 9/11 in school. They had covered the basics before then, but when she was 12, in the 6th grade, they really gave them the details. Watched videos and read newspaper articles. Wrote reports and glued clippings to poster boards. Not long after, Nell wrote a short story about a freak snowstorm in the middle of September. All the planes grounded. All airports shut down. Cap and Jules were stunned. Even though it was a child's rewrite of history, isn't that what we all did in our heads? Tapped the clock icon and scrolled the hours back, played endless versions of if this, then that. He wanted to tell Vega what he never told Nell, that the terrorists just would have done it on September 12th.
We can't control that, said Cap. We can control what we do.
Yes, she said, lips curling up on her teeth.
We can.
She turned and headed purposefully toward the cabin.
Vega! Cap called.
She whipped around and walked a few steps back to him.
I'm going in there right now. You can come or not come. If the girls are in there, I'm going to get them and bring them out here. You can come or not come.
He looked at her and really saw the color of her eyes, a mix of green and blue, thin yellow rays spiking out from the pupils, two watercolor suns. She turned to go again, and this time Cap put his hand on her shoulder with the intention of pulling her back. In a second, she grabbed his wrist and flipped it, and kept twisting it like a pipe cleaner. The pain shot through the tendons, and he grabbed the collar of her jacket with his free hand and grunted. She shoved her other hand hard against his sternum, the heel sharp right over his heart. Cap knew it was some martial arts move, something where you use the muscles of your back and midsection to push forward. He wondered if they fought, really fought, who would win. Vega's reflexes were faster, but he was probably ultimately stronger, just the cruel benefit of being bigger and a man. That said, if he had to put a dollar down on who would get up more quickly after being hit, that would be Vega. They both froze, barely breathing.
"Here's the thing, Vega," he said, barely louder than the chattering birds around them. "I think you made a mistake, too. Just not the same one as most people."
She wasn't moving. Her fingers stayed cold and clamped around his wrist. Cap kept going.
"Except instead of thinking you're too special to lose someone, you think you're special because you already have."
Vega stared at him, eyelashes coming down halfway, not even a full blink.
"I'm very sorry about your mom and your friend. Perry, right? But losing them doesn't make you special. My grandfather died from Alzheimer's and he killed a fucking Nazi with a knife."
His voice choked high when he mentioned Art. His mother's father, a small, bow-legged man, the human equivalent of a Jack Russell Terrier, always busy, building Cap cars and trucks out of thick wooden blocks. When Cap was 10, Art had told him to lose the grandpa.
"You're practically a man, Max. You can call me Art like my friends."
And then the shitty, undignified end. A bed in the vet's hospital in Bay Ridge, playing with a child's tower of rainbow rings. His nose stung, and he swallowed salt. Vega still didn't move, kept her hand against him, the other on his wrist. Cap let go of her jacket.
"If they're dead, they're already dead," he said. "If they're alive, they'll probably be alive in 30 minutes.
Vega cocked her head a little and started to open her mouth.
"We play the favorites," said Cap, "not the long shot."
She bent her elbow, and the palm on Cap's chest relaxed. Slowly, she let go of his wrist with her other hand. Then she leaned forward and kissed him forcefully on the mouth. It happened so fast he didn't have too much time to react. He felt the pressure from her lips. Soft, dry, as if she were trying to pass something through them to him, a message or a germ. Their arms were still tangled together, her one hand still resting lightly on his chest. And then she pulled away. Her eyes moved up and down his face, the neck of her black T-shirt shaking. There was no wind. It was from her heartbeat. He instantly regretted not holding tight to her shoulders and kissing her back, kissing her cheeks and her forehead and her eyelids. He realized he couldn't think of a thing to say that made sense, so he thought of what Nell would say.
"WTF, Vega."
The corner of her mouth turned up in a smile she wouldn't allow to fully occupy her face, so he focused on that tiny movement. A miracle, really.
Then, the deafening crack of a gunshot split the air around them. And it was over.
Chapter 14. They broke apart instantly and ran to the right side of the road, each behind a tree. Vega pulled the Springfield from the holster and flipped the safety. She watched Cap do the same with his ancient SIG. They waited for another shot, which didn't come. But then they heard voices, loud but unintelligible. Fighting. Vega peered through the branches to the cabin, but could see no detail, all the windows dark. "One of them didn't want the other to take the shot," she said.
"Are we certain they're shooting at us and not each other?" said Cap.
Vega strained to hear specific words, but couldn't get anything. Just a goddammit here or there from McKee, and high-pitched screeching from Dina.
"Doesn't matter. They're getting itchy in there, and they're armed," said Vega. Then she said, as if it were a full sentence, "So..."
Cap squatted, looked over his shoulder and around the tree at the cabin, then back up to Vega. There was a bluish tint to his face, from either the early light or exhaustion.
"So this is the 30 minutes, he said.
Vega said again, "And they're armed." Cap exhaled through his nose audibly, and then barely shook his head, ending a conversation between himself and himself. Finally, he said,
"Why don't you go around back? See if you can get in. I'll get in the front door."
Vega huffed out a laugh. And then what the hell are you going to do?
If the girls aren't in plain sight, then I'll talk. Distract them while you look around.
What if they are in plain sight?
Then I'll talk, distract them, wait for you. Then we shoot to wound. Below the knees, no torso. Stay away from arteries. We need to know what they know.
Vega nodded.
Let's get a little closer first, he said, standing.
He took a few steps to another tree, and then another. Vega followed him, hiding behind the same trees. Soon they reached the clearing around the cabin, which was wider than the house of the old man with the truck, more square footage but still shabby, the exterior a chipped red wood with metal-paned windows and an open porch running along the whole front of the house.
You good? Said Cap.
Vega nodded, and then started to make her way around, moving through the trees, kept the Springfield pointed down, both hands on it. Through a side window, she saw shapes, people moving. She glanced at Cap, who was staying low and thin against the tree, and she pointed to the window and then to her eyes. I see them, right here. Cap gave her a quick up nod. She continued, slowly, tree to tree, past a pair of sloped cellar doors and an old beige Honda with a peeling New York Giants sticker on the fender. The car the girls were taken in. When did Kylie realize Evan Marsh was not her friend? And neither was John McKee. When did the fear close in? Vega shook it out. Not her concern. And as usual, the wrong questions. Vega left Cap's line of vision, went behind the house. McKee and Dina were still fighting, the volume sounding the same, which meant, Vega hoped, that they had not moved too much, that they were still where Vega had just seen them, toward the center of the house and not right up front. Cap knew he had to get the 20 feet to the porch unseen, then under the window.
Why don't I keep my goddamn vest in the trunk anymore? He thought.
It was in the attic at home, in a cardboard box with untaped flaps covered in dust. The short answer was that he had not foreseen this particular situation. He had not predicted a week ago that he would be working on a police and federal investigation and would be participating in an armed hostage rescue. He momentarily grabbed hold of the idea, allowed himself to feel the fear of it, closed his eyes and thought to Nell over the father-daughter telepathic hotline, I love you, bug. That was it for the fear. He opened his eyes, gripped the SIG tighter, and ran for the house. There was no porch at the back of the house, just three narrow steps leading to a rusted screen door, wires frayed at the bottom. The inner door, red with a square window, was closed behind it. Vega stayed in the trees. She could still hear the fighting, but faintly. She tried to see through the window in the door, but the shadow from the screen was too dark. So she crouched and hustled to the door, up the three steps. She looked in. A small room, full-size bed in the corner, with a sheet and a thick blanket in a pile, a dresser with a lamp on top, bottles, papers, candy wrappers on the floor. Vega opened the screen door slowly. A squeak came and went. She grabbed the handle, pressed her thumb down on the thumb piece, and the door was not locked. The country, she thought, with an element of disdain. She pushed the door open with a little bit of pressure. It opened with a soft pop from the rubber door sweep. Then she was in. She took a couple of light steps. The door to the rest of the house was wide open, but Vega couldn't see anything except a hallway wall. Where are you, little bad? And then her answer. A girl's scream. Cap heard it as he squatted underneath a window on the porch, facing the woods, the hoarse cry followed by sobbing and garbled words in the same high child's voice. The hair on his arms straightened out, the skin on his neck iced from the sound. He heard Vega in his head. 30 minutes. Now he could hear McKee clearly.
Shut her up, Dina! Shut her up!
Fuck you!
Dina shouted. Then murmuring to the girls, Cap assumed.
Babysitter of the fucking year.
He felt footsteps shake his ribs as they grew closer, stopping right behind him. He made himself as flat as he could against the wall, guessed that McKee was looking out the window above his head.
"They're fucking gone," said McKee. "They're gonna bring the fucking National Guard on this place."
Cap could hear the slur. Drugs or booze or both. Suspect not thinking clearly. Volatile. Armed.
"Get her out!"
yelled McKee, his voice cracking. Her. A child. Kylie or Bailey. Made a mournful sound like a wounded animal. Cap's eyes fell on the cellar doors in front of the porch, and then there was movement. Two or three sets of feet coming forward to the front door, right next to him. He ran on his haunches, keeping the cig tight in one hand, pushing off the porch with the other like a chimp, and turned the corner just as the door opened. He sat against the side of the house now, and peeked around the edge, tried to breathe and slow his heart rate as he saw who came out. Vega still couldn't see. She heard the front door open and people run out, so she left the small bedroom and stepped into the hallway, pressing her back flush against the wall. Now she saw more of what she guessed was the living room, a yellow wingback chair, another open door leading to a bathroom. Dead mice and boiled meat filled her nose. She pictured hot dogs in a pan of oil-topped water. She heard no sound in the living room except a small rustle, and she imagined Bailey Brandt gagged and tied and nearly passed out on a pile of newspapers where they made her sleep.
"Wrong," Perry would have said, knocking his fist against his head like it was a door. "The hell, Vega! You're number two fuck-up."
Number one was not bringing enough firepower. Never assume you're gonna find who you're looking for. Assume you're gonna find the other thing, which will generally be someone who wants to kill you. Sometimes they're the same. He was telling her over and over, just like Little Bad and Big Bad, to get out of her head. Stop projecting and imagining and hypothesizing, because even if you're thinking of the worst thing, it was still a kind of optimism, being cocky enough to think you could see the future and get a handle on it. You have no handle. You got your gun, and you got the fire. Sometimes it's enough, and sometimes it isn't. She got closer to the end of the hallway, and she saw more of the living room, a couch with a sheet over it, a pile of clothes. And just as she realized the hallway was more of a partition, a thin wall between the back room and the front of the house, she heard a creak and a catch of breath, and she turned the corner with her Springfield out. But McKee was right there, waiting for her, swinging a plank of wood at her, and he cracked it over her forehead and right eye. Then it was shock. Blood. Bright white. Then black. Dina Mocht wore cutoffs and a pink tank top, dressed for summer in not yet 50-degree weather. She had the same eyes as her mother, blue and set close together, except hers were bright and agonized, whereas Mrs. Mocht was past all that, long since resigned to bland disappointment. Dina had a gun in one hand but held it awkwardly, no finger on the trigger. Her other arm was wrapped around Bailey Brandt. Cap curved his body around like a ribbon and pressed his face against the side of the house so he could get a better look. Bailey's face was buried in Dina's ribs. Her blonde hair was stringy and snaky down her back, and she wore the pink dress she'd been kidnapped in, the tulle wrinkled and ripped in the skirt. Cap shook his head to an invisible audience and bit the inside of his cheeks. Those fuckers hadn't given her a bath or changed her clothes for 6 days. Dina did not have the gun pointed at Bailey, but it could be there quickly. These things could unravel in a second, Cap knew. There was no fight, and then there were fists. No accident, and then a pile-up. No gunshots. And then, suddenly, blood and brains. Dina was steering Bailey slowly toward the car when McKee called from the house,
"I got one, Dina! I got one!"
He sounded giddy, like a kid catching frogs. Cap cringed.
"Damn it, Vega, how'd you get caught?"
Dina's eyes went wild as she held the gun up, pointing it at the sky.
"Get her in the car!"
shouted McKee. Dina shuffled toward the car, pulling Bailey, who moved like she was sleepwalking.